Good morning, Mr. Rowan. It's March 4th, 2009, and the last in our series of interviews. And today I think we're going to concentrate a little bit on your stories and memories about Thunder Bay and its connection to your work. So, just feel free to chat.
I'd done my high school in Kingston, Ontario. I'm certainly well grounded, and I knew about Port Arthur and Fort William, but I had never been west of Kingston or Toronto. So I joined up during the war service, and we went by train. We were all people from Eastern Canada, all the way from Quebec City, all the way to southern Saskatchewan, at Mossbank, Saskatchewan. Not even with the sleeper cars in coaches in those days. But I recall the train stopping at Port Arthur and Fort William, and the first thing that surprised me that there was a difference in time, though they were close together. That's where the time changed in those days. And I noticed from afar the size, some of the elevators and all of those. I didn't really been that familiar with them. I knew about grain elevators and that because for the previous two summers I had worked on passenger vessels out of Montreal with Canada Steamship Lines had passenger vessels. And I saw the grain elevators in Montreal. Then we stopped at Sorel, which had an elevator at Three Rivers in Quebec. And I would look at those and then ask people, and they told me that it was for grain, and I saw ships unloading and loading from a distance. So I had some familiarity. But I really got a lesson of that because we served in southern Saskatchewan. And when I saw the signs of the grain fields at that time and the growing of grain, I had quite an experience there. And then shortly after I finished my course in Saskatchewan, I had 2 days before posting, I went up with a pilot who did aerobatics and I ruptured my appendix and I was sent home. So I went to Thunder Bay and Port Arthur twice there and on the way back to going back to Winnipeg. I was then stationed at Stevenson Field here in Winnipeg where I graduated in 42. But this one time I had a longer stop at the train, I forget what it was for, and I talked to somebody that was locally about the elevator, so he says he'd want to see something. He took me by car. I remember having gone out and very impressed that there were so many and so much green, never realizing that years later that I would be associated with that. So that was my first experience with them. Then in my work after the war, I was with the Maritime Commission the first time. I had reason to do a study of all the shipyards and the vessels that had been built in Canada. Really, there were questions that were asked in Parliament quite often about it. And the answers didn't all jive all the time from different countries. So I started investigating from wartime shipbuilding and others, and I have records about ships that had been built and how the names that were given. But I recall towards the end, for the first time I recalled, that it was surprising that they built small coasters in Port Arthur, at the Port Arthur shipyard at the time. And so that was a revelation I had. I have the names of those ships and the years that they were built and how much they cost.
I'll try to get a copy of that from you if I could.
Yeah. So later, I advanced. I was seconded my work to the transport controller. There was a big demand, and there had been no export trade or major import from 1939 almost through to the 50s. And by this time, there was a increasing export demand, and maybe the different exporters were exaggerating their needs to the railways, so they had to appoint a transport controller to find out exactly which were the priorities and the need. I was seconded to the transport controller's office. And one of the major exports was grain. He, the transport controller, was very familiar with grain. He had been in that during his career in Manitoba, and he was out in Alberta as well.
I think you've mentioned this name before, but what was the fellow's name?
Mr. R.W. Milner.
Right.
And during that, to familiarize myself, I came out out west and spent maybe a week in a country elevator to see the work that they did, the grain dooring cars and how the cars were loaded and how they were. Then trains would pick them up and take them to Thunder Bay to various terminals. And stopped in at Thunder Bay at that time to see the grain commission and people of those. Getting records. And that was the first. And a few years later, the Canadian Wheat Board hired me to open an office in Montreal. And from this office, most of the shipping industry for Eastern Canada was located in Montreal. So from there, the paperwork and the work was done about loading to export out of Churchill, out of the Atlantic ports, all the St. Lawrence ports. And there were even smaller vessels at that time, foreign vessels, that went through the Great Lakes and had got as far as Thunder Bay and were loading like flaxseed and other things, so we were familiar about it at that time. So I did get to know some of some of the personnel. And not what particular orders of companies involved that night, like Patterson Steamships. I met John Patterson quite well, and they had very good personnel that they had over the years, particularly the chaps in Montreal and Thunder Bay that worked for John. Other companies at that time, like Canada Steamship Lines and Upper Lakes and Algoma, steel plants and everything else. So for Patterson to expand into it was rather difficult. But these personnel that they had that really were very good and got as far down as the St. Lawrence with canalers and in various trades and pulpwood into various plants into Three Rivers. Intercoastal trade, even in the St. Lawrence, and they had smaller vessels. And they had a specialty trade starting at that time. So I knew those people, some of them, quite well. And we'd meet the shipping people once a year. In mentioning that the vessels of Patterson partook, particularly in the coastal trade and in transporting potatoes at seasons of that there were potatoes from the Maritimes now. The coastal trade and shipping rather goods from one place of Canada to the other have to be ships built in Canada and operating in Canada or the UK, the British is that we had. But they could bring in foreign vessels if Canadian ships weren't available to move the cargo, you would apply to the Department of Transport. But in the United States, there is no very, the ship must be built in the United States, must be owned by Americans, not people from outside the country, and having American crews, and that still goes on today, whether from Alaska or Hawaii or Puerto Rico or any place from California to the east, it's done. Any exceptions that they have, they very rarely, has to be enacted in Congress. Mm. They had a number of canalers that they had when they got started. You know, they didn't build new ships when they started. Had been built in the United States, a whole series. And I have a list of those and the names. And they got permission to operate in Canada, naturally. Then the Americans, shortly after the war, a big shortage of vessels, particularly moving to ore and coal, the steel companies that were along in the Great Lakes. So at that emergency, we came to our attention that these vessels of Patterson might be. So they went through the procedure, and the Americans got the necessary legislation passed to permit those ships to come in. And I was one keeping track of the records of what grain that they were moving either from Duluth going to Buffalo and to Toledo and everything else, the feed grain business from them, the American funds, but also cargoes, the readily many two-way cargoes that they could get. Mm-hmm. So this was very helpful to them and certainly helpful to the Americans, you can imagine. For them to pass legislation that it was a crisis at the time. So I recall that very, that another thing where Canada came and helped out.
Was that a short-term agreement or did that apply?
Oh, a couple of seasons, yeah. Until they started getting steel then and to build in the shipyards that they're in the Great Lakes and that. Because the fleet that they had were older, or they hadn't built during the war, everything was done for... Anyways, that was quite an opportunity again from Thunder Bay and... And of the, yeah, the personnel that coming from Thunder Bay, there was and Mr. Howe, the former premise moved from Thunder Bay, was when he went to Ottawa, he was in business by that, built elevators. He brought some personnel, one or two from Thunder Bay for him. There was a Mr. Bennett, and Bill Bennett, who was his executive assistant, I guess, or somebody that was with him there. And he was quite an individual, did very well. He was a good listener, I guess, from others at various meetings, being with the minister. I had occasion to get to know him like that. My dad was the secretary of the National Harvest Board of the various ports in Canada then, and that was came under that tenure. And I remember Mr. Bennett from those days. All those years. But after that, once the Seaway was built, there was ore mines were found that developed down on the Quebec North Shore in Labrador. And that was developed by the various American companies, and they wanted to transport the ore from there into the Great Lakes. The Big Lakers of CSL and others were available, they would come and unload grain in Montreal and that, but then having to go all the way for get ore there, and this would then, I guess, never come out, but it would be there. They were suppliers for Stelco and for Dofasco and for Algoma. So I don't know how anxious that they were. They would have ships available to move this and there. So this Iron Ore Company of Canada, which was involved, built two ships. And Mr. Bennett, by this time, was the president of Iron Ore Company. He came from Thunder Bay. They had these two vessels loaded and built in Canada, just like the others had, with the special policy of the vessel, the ocean vessels that had been built and fun. So they could move ore. And by that time, Cargill had built an elevator at Baie-Comeau, so these fellows could take one cargo of grain to Baie-Comeau, either American or Canadian, and not far to get the ore. And subsequently, an elevator was built at Port Cartier by Dreyfus, and that's where the ore was being loaded at. By that time, other companies had followed up and were available, moving the grain at the... he was able to sell those ships. Cargill bought them in time.
I didn't realize that Cargill had a fleet.
Yeah, good to have two Canadian flag vessels, and they could get ownership and all the benefits of the others. So vessels did, other companies then were interested in going as far as Port Cartier with grain. Very good, it was additional, they could unload there. This Mr. Bennett certainly had quite a career. And from then, after he ended that terminology, he was always interested in something new from then. He then became a director of the Canadian Pacific Railway. Mm. So I met with him and met with him a few times at that. I mean, he's from Thunder Bay, young chap, very bright, conscientious. So those people quietly made quite a contribution. When you see one individual as a young chap coming to Ottawa and listening, and
did you meet Mr. Howe as well?
And I was working for Mr. Milner, the transport controller. There were demands in from the Canadian Wheat Board of how much transportation they would need to move grain to Thunder Bay. And he turned this over to me and asked me if I would examine this. And I looked at every statistic of what each individual elevator could unload, what the ships could carry, even if it take it all to Georgian Bay and the ship could come back quicker and could come on. And I really reviewed, because to me it didn't make sense that they could move that much grain or have sailed. And one day he asked me, he'd been away, came back, I'd looked at this, and he said, "Well," I said, "I don't think they can do this." He says, "Why?" So you have to know the man. So I then buy elevator, take the small ones or the big one. The most cars they ever unloaded in a day was this. And if the Lakers ever get the cars to load them. He didn't say too much. Well, keep looking at it. So one morning, or one afternoon, his secretary mentioned, "Would you go to the number one temporary building in Ottawa, temporary building, on Wellington tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock? Mr. Milner will be there." So I was there plenty early with it. And no personnel of that, but the gentleman at the desk, and he said, "They're down the hall." And there I went down the hall, and sure, Mr. Milner was there. But then I noticed the minister was Mr. Howe. And I don't know whether they were playing cribbage or whatever. So I sat down, and then I recalled that Mr. Howe, I guess, mentioned that the Wheat Board had this big program and what was being done about this. And Mr. Milner said he didn't have time too much to look at it, but turned it over to me. And he told me to get my word. Apparently the minister said, "Well, how does he know about it?" And unkind words. But I kept on, I mean, with the figures. So that was the first time that I met him. It was quite an episode.
So did he say anything about your figures? Or he just
listened? He just wanted, and that I brought out more figures than the figures what I had, so that quietly then went on to another subject. So subsequently, met him a few times. And, but the next best episode was when he was in, when he retired. Now he's the manager of the Montreal office. And one weekend I read on the paper that he had been appointed as director, senior director of Ogilvy Flour Mills. And a secretary from Ogilvy Flour Mills. He knew, I guess, I was with the board and asked if I'd be available sometime to drop around. It says, is it convenient this afternoon? And I said, fine, it was not far. I was from the Board of Trade. I could go up to him. And so I went up and see him, and here he's in his big boardroom in the Sunlight Building with pictures of former presidents. And so he then mentioned that at the meeting, that the first board meeting that he was at that morning, they were mentioning about some problems they were having with the wheat board about this. And he says, I'm sure that that is, can't be a problem as bad as that, what they're having. And you're familiar about that. So I've been around quite a bit by that time. So, well, I said, have you got what has happened prior to the Seaway? Ships, the grain was transferred at Press at Port Colborne, Kingston, from bigger lakers to small canalers. These carried about 2,500 tons, the biggest 100,000 bushel, but there were some 2,000 tons, a small vessel. And they'd come down the Lachine Canal to Montreal. Just before the port, Ogilvy had a mill. Their mill was located right on the canal, so they could unload directly from the small canalers into their elevator. Now the grain, some grain, was coming or larger lakers, and then they would have to unload on the Montreal elevator in the port. And they had had a gallery built. Their previous chairman had been a former minister, to take the grain directly to Ogilvy's. But the extra handling through the elevator and that to go. So naturally that the pricing, as if it came through the elevator, big elevator, and there was extra cost, they would have to pay more than unloading from the canalers. So I didn't have to tell them anything. I just stopped the car and I said, there's the elevator. And up until this year, it says it all came down in canalers, mainly transferring at Kingston or other things like that. And now, I says that since the Seaway, this is in, it didn't have to write it out for him.
So how was the how was Ogilvy thinking that this was a problem created by the wheat board?
So, yeah, they would have liked the grain. They were paying one price that was cheaper from canalers than paying the extra price. That I didn't have to write anything out for them this way. So I waited about a week, and I called my associate over in Ogilvy. He would call me about grain all the time. And I said, I noticed you have a new chairman. As he showed up in the office, he said, Jesus, don't talk about that. I said, what? Yeah, well, he said this question of the dual prices and everything, and they brought that up. And he says, you know, some even the chaps working here, the senior people, they haven't even been down to see that elevator. So he knew more about it than I did. And he said, anyways, he made quite an impression at that. And then saw him a few times other than that, but, Then he called one day after that about, was I free for lunch? I did. joined one of those clubs. He had been in Ottawa, but at the Rideau Club, but as a minister. I mean, he didn't have to sign in or anybody else do it for him. But this year, now it was, I mean, he would have to sign in for lunch. So he assumed that I had been going to that club, which we didn't belong, but I had been there. So he asked me, he said, I know the procedure. By that time, at Robin Hood, I told him, Mr. McIver, who had been the chairman of the wheat board for many years, was the chairman of Robin Hood. And the first time I went to the club was with him when he did it. So I told Mr. Howley, he just thought that that was the greatest. At least that's your guy. I knew where, he says, I knew where to come to get the right things done. So it's those things, the human side of them that are, yeah.
What was your impression of him in...
Oh yeah, it was very straightforward. I mean, yeah, knowledgeable and very personable. I'd like with Mr. Milner. So then he told me about when he first knew this Roy Milner. So Mr. Howe had told me he'd come from the States and into Canada, and he was engaged finally by the Board of Grain Commissioners to inspect elevators. They're responsible for licensing elevators and that. And he eventually, since there were many more out here, he moved out to Thunder Bay working for them. And then decided on his own about building elevators. He'd seen about the structures and everything else and that. So he undertook and he got a contract from a consortium from Alberta, he said, from the West. Those at the times that these were companies like Searle Grain, Federal Grain and that, and they worked together to build up a terminal. So he got a contract, and he started in, rather than wait in the fall, the weather was good, they started construction, not construction, but getting the docks ready for putting up the elevator. In the fall, and then late in the season, the terrible weather, the conditions of waves and everything else, which did a lot of harm to what they had done. So this cost him a lot of money. He had to go down east to see if he could get more money to build the elevator. Talked out Mrs. Howe was expecting and the whole things involved. And so then he was able to finish the elevator in the spring on time. In those days you had to finish it at a certain date and a flat price. And but he was convinced then that that was, it wasn't a business for him. So he said that people came from Western Canada that he'd met before. They toured the elevator and the facilities with their manager. Everything was in order. And he was asked if there had been cost overruns and everything else like that. And he said, yes, there was. So anyway, shortly after the meeting, he said, this man came along, was Mr. Milner. And he says, what were all those costs? They went over figures and this and this and that. And then a few hours later, he said, later that day he came and he said, they offered them so much this and that, in addition to what they had. And he says, that's why I got back into the business after that. He says, that's when I first met Roy Milner. Mm. Yeah.
So their relationship went back for
a
distance.
Long time, yeah. Yeah, when they were traveling.
I remember one time when we were chatting, you also talked about the people in Montreal who you met that were responsible for, was it loading grain in Thunder Bay? The stevedores?
Yes. Well, they're companies at Montreal. I knew all the various stevedoring companies. But certain ones came and went, particularly when the Seaway gave open to load. And ocean boats to go load in the lakes. Studies had been made because when the Seaway was to open an ocean boat, none of the other than small size 2,000 tonners that any of those elevators, either there or Duluth or anything, had ever done. This was not like loading Lakers, although completely. So. There was a group that met. I was part of that group from the grain trade, and that went down and met with all the vessel agents and companies in the East, asking them what was necessary about to load ocean boats and then the Great Lakes. And a study was made. I think I showed it to you that I guess the decision was made at that time that there's a. They didn't anticipate seeing ocean boats coming in, and it was much easier pouring grain into a laker, coming back and forth, than and then making necessary adjustments to. There were so many elevators, and whatever the reason, they didn't. But on the American side, they sure did make new facilities in Toledo and every other places to get grain. Because prior to that, they weren't shipping through the St. Lawrence for export. They had to rail it all to New Orleans or to Baltimore and these other places. So, really nothing was done at Thunder Bay of any major size. It would have been difficult with that many terminals. You weren't going to load them all. You'd have to select a certain few, which are already of a size. That would mean some dredging, but particularly lifting the spouts and everything else to do. I can see why they didn't.
And all of the elevators, or a lot of the elevators, would have been owned by smaller companies, where that cost would be rather large.
Yeah, but physically also, they're doing it. They're having ocean boats that come in at different sizes. They're up the Cam River and up in these places like that. So the decision was made. And then when it came as for stevedoring, since stevedoring wouldn't open an office there because it's a minimal trade, they were hiring, they would have to hire people that were loading boats in there. They'd send people up because they weren't familiar about loading ocean vessels at the time. But they did open offices in Duluth, though. Montreal's companies from Montreal, because they were unfamiliar with in those ports, the longshoremen about loading vessels. And then there was the big technicalities that they hadn't thought of. The Great Lakes were fresh water. These were used to salt water, so the buoyancy when they load cargo is different. It's amazing that subject, that salt water ended about 20 miles east of Three Rivers. So between Quebec and Three Rivers, it's tidal, that Three Rivers may be only under a foot, but at Quebec up to 12 feet tide. But at a place called Batiscan, you see the color of the water changes quite wild. It goes from salt water to fresh water. Nobody can explain why. But the buoyancy of that made it quite a difference of a bigger cargo.
So that meant, what did that mean for loading in Thunder Bay then, the difference in
the buoyancy? No. It meant the change in Montreal and everything else. But they... The terminals weren't particularly interested in that trade. They figured that to do well enough, they did better in loading Lakers. They're just pouring it into the others now. But the basic advantage, or the potential, was in other grains, in rye and flax and rapeseed, which were private companies, not like with the wheat board. Anyways, they went, but I can see with that many companies and which ones want to spend the money, and before they spend it, and we've already got that.
But they changed in any case over time.
Oh, but they lost the business in the meantime, yeah. This grain from Saskatchewan is easily sent to rail to Duluth quite a bit over the years. And, but anyways, that has been done, and you see what's happened.
That's grain out of the chute.
Yeah. But, the problem is getting a unanimous decision among them all, with all the various companies and that. So similarly on the All Rail, as far exporting in Eastern Canada, that once the season closed at the end of the season, because of the ice condition, we get demand, but the grain could only be shipped out of maritime ports, and it was all rail from the Atlantic ports, from the Georgian Bay, from Collingwood and Midland and Owen Sound, Goderich and Sarnia. And so that's the maximum that we could do business right across. And then in meeting, having met with railways, I was in Montreal for years, I knew them, knew their problem. Once they unloaded in Montreal at Thunder Bay at the end of the season to fill the elevators, all the damn empty cars had to be sent all the way down to Georgian Bay to load grain from those elevators to go to the Maritime. So in my mind, why not load them at Thunder Bay, go down to the Atlantic ports and come back to Georgian Bay? Already we could export another couple of million bushels or tons. Oh, the railway said that that would be great, and so they quoted a rate. So their problem was that there was the Hatton East rate that governed all the exports of grain from the prairies to Vancouver and Thunder Bay, a fixed rate, which was a very contentious thing. And if they gave a better rate about going from Thunder Bay to Halifax. Anyways, I negotiated with them and got there. First we took some down to Quebec City, which was easy. Ocean boats could get there. Some to the Maritime, but then Quebec City installed equipment, and they're big time today. But it was extra grain out of the country. It was extra business for the railways and the delivery of it. But the contentious thing was with the Hatton East rates, with when
the Crow
they do
rates?
A bigger,
is that the same as the Crow rates? The
Crow rate, yeah. The Crow rate. No, I should have, not the Hatton East, the Crow rate, yeah. And that caused a big problem, and then subsequently an agreement was made to change it, and that just, but by then, the changes that were made subsequently is, it's amazing, all in my time, when I was started at the week before, there were 5,000. We went from boxcars to hopper cars, and all of these changes were, the big one from the metric system came in effect, had dramatic changes in it.
How did the metric system have a dramatic effect? You'd like to forget about it?
No. Just, I was involved up to here.
Those who might be listening to this who are younger than we are, when was this, the metric system was brought in? 60s, 70s, early 70s?
In the 60s, I guess, in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. I know I was in Winnipeg, yeah.
Starting
in the 60s and the 70s. Oh, on that subject, once there was a meeting at the wheat board where a minister came up and personnel, and they met with in the boardroom. And they had a list of questions. And the second or third question was asked, what was the board doing about the metric system? So the chairman says, you know, it was government policy. And all our overseas clients are basis this, and so we adopted it. Says, but Frank's got a story to that, and I'm not at the table, I'm sitting in the front. And go ahead. Anyways, I told him this past winter, I was spent some time down in San Diego on a holiday, golf holiday, and from the hotel we saw the license plates of some Saskatchewan.
They had the farmer's tan.
So I mentioned to them that went down, said hello, and I was at the wheat board. And I said they didn't ask about quotas. What quotas is, how much can they deliver grain, or the initial price. And they said, what about this GD metric system? So I gave the answer that Mr. McNamara had, but I told him, I said, that I can't avoid, because I was on the committee of how do we convert this to the metric system, the system that we have. So I said, basically, in your case, all of you know, you're either trucking it or with horse and buggy to country elevator, say, with a truck or the grain. And when you did, they would weigh the truck and the grain when the grain was unloaded.
Yeah. So before
at the country elevator, they would weigh the grain and the truck. And then once the grain was unloaded, there's a weight in pounds. Then they convert it then to bushels, because that's how they get paid in the elevator, so much a bushel and then the storage. Then when they loaded, the elevator took the brake and the beam, I'm quite sure they covered themselves at better prices. Then when they loaded into a rail car, it went from bushels to short tons loading to the railway, so there's a conversion made. And people making in the offices and involved in commission. When it got to Thunder Bay, unload the rail car, it went from short tons back to bushels. Then when it loaded from the elevators from bushels to long tons on Lakers, the metric, and then change it for bushel because part of it is paid to the Americans. It got to the St. Lawrence. And it unloaded then from long tons back to bushels in the elevator and to metric tons on the ocean boat. And I would estimate on a year like last year that could be as high as 3 million bushels involved in that's lost in the conversions. No elevator ever had a shortage, an overage, and that trade went to the local millers and feed and everything else. But don't blame them, that's the system that takes it on. And all they said, I shouldn't repeat.
You shouldn't repeat what he said?
Oh, no, that was Mr. Mazenkowski and these others that killed a lot. They couldn't get over it. They were pursuing it, which is true. And those that were employed in that, and the statistics. You know, there was nothing wrong. That was the system that was in effect at the time.
Then what?
It's all on the metric.
It's all on metric, so none of this except for the American.
What it cost them is a reverse amazing. On everything they export, their equipment, automobiles and aircraft and everything else. They signed the same agreement as Canada, but then they had to have the various states. I guess would cause the trouble, but that's their problem.
So they're still then dealing with conversion costs, and we've got out of that.
Oh yeah, yes.
So did it run smoothly then with the conversion?
Yes, it's done gradually, and it's done. It's interesting. I have one of my sons who just works at the Crane Commission, been there 25 years. And he asked me one day, Dad, what? And I won't say the words. What's this about bushels? He says, what's that? And he was unfamiliar even with bushels.
So back to Thunder Bay, the changes that you were talking about, the early days and talking to Mr. Howe, and then when you started work with the wheat board here, you must have seen some changes in the relationship between the wheat board and shipments out of Thunder Bay.
Yeah, the shipments at Byers, I mean, the big change by Eastern Canada. Our main client for many years was United Kingdom and the UK. And up until 1936, at that time, authorities in Canada would go to London, tell us how much we produced, and the British would say how much they wanted. Had to go to them. They were the major market at that time. Well, the big change as far as East is concerned, or one of the major change, was the common market. They had started after the war of the common, this is a whole story about Germany and Holland and that, but they formed a common market so that they could, no tariffs or moving the facility. It was very successful in that field. And then they started looking into others and said, look, and another thing we have, we're importing so much grain, other facilities. People here never thought that they could do anything about it, but they certainly did over the years. Take for France, produces more wheat than Canada. It's very high yielding wheat. I don't say it's not the same quality that we have. Where we get in bushels of 40 or 50 bushels an acre, they're getting 125. Mm. But it's not of the same quality that is here. But it sure changed the market dramatically. Until then, they started exporting some of this, even to the Far East. Mm. So we then, North America changed, particularly our neighbors to the south, to other grains that are going to Europe, soybeans and corn and other things that have. And Canada, particularly in eastern part of western Canada, how would I say this? That here in Manitoba particularly, we have the Assiniboine River and the Red River. And most each spring there's flooding in both of these rivers that extends some distance depending on the either side. And grain was grown in those fields. Basically it wasn't a top quality type of wheat that could be used. But surveys were made in time that this land, that particular sugar beets and potatoes and everything else like that. And from that, you take from Portage la Prairie out to Carvery and those things, they now grow up to 5 million tons of potatoes. Mm-hmm. A major compared to what PEI and New Brunswick and plants have opened. So that is a change. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a lot of change of other varieties of peas and lentils and other feed that have replaced the wheat and grain that we know, and some of that is most of that is shipped or bagged here. I guess some of them load at Thunder Bay and vessels, and others are shipped.
When you
so a large, a significant percentage of the, particularly in this province, in that chain. Province is just one example. There's others in Alberta. I mean, there were so many disruptions in their shipments in the winter out of the Pacific because of labor disputes. Mm-hmm. They have a major industry in cattle, and so they grow a lot more feed barley than here. Even the feed barley here that is used often, this just comes from Alberta. So growing it themselves, looking at what it could do within the country.
When you were with the Wheat Board, did you visit Thunder Bay regularly, or that was sort of the responsibility of others once you had worked on the sales?
Yeah, but I was a part of my job was a movement from Eastern Canada because I was involved in that. I think you'll see.
Talked about before, I think. Okay. Just off the recording, we were doing some talk, and the topic came up of the lake shippers. This is sort of our first discussion on tape of lake shippers, and who exactly are, or what
lake
is
shippers.
The lake shippers?
It was the Lake Shippers Clearance Association. Well, you can imagine with the number of elevators that are at Thunder Bay with different companies. When grain got unloaded and cleaned, they would get a certified certificate that they had so much in there. So like a bank, they had an account that is in. And the Wheat Board, a copy of the certificate or the original certificate were issued in Winnipeg, the cost that came from the prairies, and the certificate came in the Wheat Board's name as far as the wheat and barley are concerned. So when we came to order, a laker came in. Oh, it was quite a system. The lake company with Canada Steamship Lines or something would declare, say that they'd offer the board the boat. They had an overall contract and say we have the Coverdale coming in for 600,000 tons, and we presented it so much to Pethick Grain or two other grain companies. These grain companies would come over to us, ask what grade is to be loaded, and they would get the certificate. They would then, with a note from us, file to the Lake Shippers in Winnipeg office to release so much to Northern to load the Coverdale. So as if all that grain came from a pool and it would be loaded out and...
But it wouldn't come out of the same elevator, and that's what the Lake Shippers group did?
It didn't name a particular elevator. Yeah. Turned it on. Yeah, you got it off?
Nope.
No, I was.
A fair question?
Yeah, well, what do you mean that changed us as I seen that? It was after the Seaway and it went,
So now we're talking about the changes.
And just to tell you, the big changes that was really what started it all. You can imagine, prior to this, that they would load up as much, the farmers would deliver to country elevators, and they would get paid an initial price. And the initial price was the Thunder Bay price, but deducting off that, the cost of moving, elevation, and it in stores. Then there was, when there was a lot of grain, that there was a government policy, there were more curling rinks built and other things in Western Canada that would store grain, and they would get paid. Even hangars from those airfields at the Commonwealth Air Training Plant was filled with grain. They would load Thunder Bay to the capacity. So the big money was made of them borrowing from the banks, because they paid all the farmers for that. So the banks, it was a Klondike at the quarter. And then the storage facilities. So today, my dear girl, the country elevator, the farmers, and today, the one big farmer that I know, for example, he books Cargill and Richardson. They buy from him at a price. They send the truck, they pick it up at the country elevator and handling. So overall, the return to individual farmers is tremendous, where in the past, the big cost. And don't blame the system. I mean, that's what it was at that time, and they knew. But they just exaggerated it. So the changes came when these companies saw that the storage wasn't going to be available.
Or needed,
yeah. As they're in a storage on the farm. But the farmers were subsidizing out of that price all of this thing. But that was the system in those days. Today, I mean, a much better return. And once they saw that, the companies would just get out of the elevator business.
So that would be a reason for the decline in prairie elevators and... And the terminal elevators as well?
Hmm?
And the terminal elevators as well, a decline in the need for storage.
Interior terminal.
Terminal elevators at Thunder Bay.
Yeah, well, the companies made the decisions, huh? That and then they used to say that the municipal organization had raised the taxes up and up and up on the buildings on more and more, and they had warned them against them, and so some of them had just sold the terminals. But it just, and then the big and then they would have had to make big changes. When the hopper cars came, they all had dumpers for the box cars, and breaking up and the staff those cars. Hopper cars was such a difference. It didn't need all of that equipment or can handle. 35 hopper cars were the equivalent of 120 boxcars, 110 to 120. Every boxcar country elevator, they had to be grain doors in it, up to about 6-7 feet in the elevator to load. Those for oil seeds had to be papered inside in all of them. So you can imagine then when they got a Thunder Bay or whatever terminal, they broke those grain doors to get the grain to turn out, all that wood that went. The amount of personnel that was involved is just. But it with hopper cars, I mean, here they just flow in, and as you say, 35 of them compared to 120. So you didn't have to shunt them from elevator to elevator. And
quite a change there.
Well, today, a train load of 10,000 tons of wheat out of Brandon can go to Montreal or Quebec and be backed out of Brandon in 7 or 8 days after having unloaded. No switching at Thunder Bay. They go all the way in there on weekends. So the cost, I mean, this is why CNR, the money they're making, the CP and those.
So a lot of efficiencies that...
Oh, yes, sir. The hopper cars and the handling the elevators like Quebec City, then the first all-rail train. Now they don't even need the switch engine to move the cars in as they're unloaded, a very modern system of unloading, and they added facilities. And before, you'd have to, what limited the exports too, is that starting already in a month before the close of navigation, or 2 months, we'd have to reduce the stocks out of Montreal, many of the eastern elevators, to protect it of the grain they brought in for the flour mills, for all of the domestic feed, for the whole winter. They went cheap by water, so the space was taken up. Where now they only buy when they get it when they need it. But it was put down with the farmer, the wheat down to Montreal, and the mills only paid when they took the wheat out of the elevator in Montreal.
And someone had to pay for the storage in the meantime.
Well, the same.
Who would pay for that down there then?
The wheat board.
The wheat board. Oh, okay. So, in this discussion then, it seems we've talked about a few things that have changed the face of the Thunder Bay waterfront. Markets is a big one. That the change in markets shifting from the UK and Europe to the Eastern, China, Japan, and so on, have shifted where the grain has gone. Another thing, the change in the need for storage because of more storage being done on the farms. Change in the speed with which things can be transferred into and out of the elevators with the changing in essentially the grain cars.
Yeah.
And the fact that more product is shipped by rail through past Thunder Bay straight down to the eastern ports.
Less handling, all this handling. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the other item, and I know it's something that, that you've had involvement with as a Thunder Bayer, we always had, there was always the gossip on the street about the impact of the Port of Churchill as a essentially a competitor for the Port of Thunder Bay. What do you have to say about that? Did or does the existence of Churchill make much difference to
No more there than it does to St. Lawrence.
Say a bit more about that.
Because the any grain out of Thunder Bay and the Churchill season was a limited season. Most of the grain that went out of there, I would say almost all of it, none from Manitoba, came from northern Saskatchewan and northern Alberta. A very good return, as you can imagine, just from that elevator to the farmers rather than the system through country elevators. And
why is that? Straight into boxcars and up to the elevator?
No, but a much shorter distance. Much shorter distance. And really, that the board system has a to give all the producers an opportunity to deliver grain. You have to take, if we open a quota, we have to take it from all the areas at some time to give those farmers an opportunity to deliver. And I mean to railways, to have them rail from the Peace River District or northern Saskatchewan always, either to Vancouver or Thunder Bay. Yeah, I know they say that, but it's the grain, just like it's out of Prince Rupert, comes from Peace River District. And Churchill, the elevator was there since the early 30s or something like that.
And it's...
And primarily to the UK, but after that it went to many other destinations.
Was it a pretty steady...
No. It was interesting, during the war... They couldn't operate that. They didn't operate all the war years. The submarines were towards the north. And there was, I have a complete record downstairs of every year what was shipped. And I think there was about 700,000 to 800,000 bushels of wheat, which is about 20,000 tons. And the American grain, they have to ship from the Dakotas all the way to the Atlantic. It's very expensive. Well, the Americans sent two or three ships escorted by naval vessels all the way to Churchill and loaded that during the war records. I have the quantities of it.
And where were they shipping it to?
To Baltimore.
For use internally?
Oh, yeah, sure. It was a lot cheaper than taking it out of the loot, the rail cars.
Really?
So it was idle all those times, but the only shipment they had was that one shipment at that time. So it's quite a history. I've been up there many times.
Any changes there?
Well, now that it's not, that it's It's operated by a private company, an American company.
The same company that owns the rail lines?
They don't own to operate, but have an agreement. Well, that's the only way to get there. And before, it was only the CN, and CN, it was taken off their overall. There was a Bracken formula that CP would get so much and CN would get so much.
Bracken formula for get so much grain business?
Rail. They had a percentage that was set. And the Churchill one didn't interest the CN going all the way there and back. And now they could, this company can take from CP and CN. And they take it, deliver it. Below the paw, there's a place. And they have their own locomotives or engine that pick up the cars and bring them back, and they don't only pay for that time that it's on their track. A good agreement for them.
A good agreement for the rail company owners or the...
Oh yeah, for the producers, the elevators. But the other business has developed coming in.
Such as?
See, they don't publicize it in the papers.
So what's coming in?
Ore.
From?
The hard and difficult, the mines are getting deeper and finding it, huh? So they get ore very, very reasonable and just have to take it in when they need it from Churchill. And so because they have good refineries.
So where would it be coming in from? Places like Russia?
No.
Yeah,
Russia would have some, but I don't think so.
You're not at liberty to say?
Yeah.
Can't be top secret.
Yeah. Cuba and other places.
Cuba and other places.
Yeah.
Or from Cuba. Really? This is fascinating stuff, isn't it? We're running close to the end of our time, and
yeah.
I just have a couple of more general questions that I wanted to ask before we sort of wrap up, because this is our last interview. And it's more just from a personal point of view.
You wanted one of these?
Yes, thank you. Your bio information.
Here's the Second World War.
So, as you look back on your career, what brought you the most satisfaction, would you say, in the grain industry? What would you say brought you the most satisfaction?
Oh yeah, it's very difficult to answer. Met an awful lot of good people, interesting people, but caring people. When you think other than growing it, it was very difficult in handling it. But personnel in foreign countries that are importing from their country, knowing that it's a food product or, yeah, not like any other job, a lot of very good people looking for quality and supply them, whether there's mills in the UK or people in North Africa or people in China. And
so it's really, your career's really given you an opportunity to see the world and to promote Canada.
With another, you ask about markets. Quite a story with the manager of our London office. We were the first ones to go to Hong Kong in 1962 and spent about three weeks or a month in that area in China. The first purchases that China made of wheat from Canada, and then involved in that delivery of that grain. Pardon the CEDA, the World Food Program, would honor the Red Cross.
We haven't talked about that. Tell me something about the Wheat Board's work with CETA.
Well, first of all, the best policy is that I still believe the Canadian government's policy. We do most of our donations or much to the World Food Program, who then assist in feeding people in make work projects in different countries, whether they are a country that are digging wells or building railways, like a railway across the Sahara, that certain grains or products that they produce food to feed those people and their families during those areas. So it is a very good. And most of Canada's grain or that we give in that way through CETA get good recognition, so that we're not giving to particular countries and expecting something in return, and we're looked upon. Similarly with the Red Cross, they get portions of that recognition. So
through CETA? They get portions through CETA, or it's a separate program?
So the department that gives out funds for that, the ministry.
What's UNRWA? United Nations
Relief?
Relief,
yeah. So the key personnel that were there, some of them mean well or unfamiliar or they have problem. In time, some of them have become clients to Canada, some of these. We were as anxious to provide the most effective type of grain for the country that's receiving. Before, to them, it was just grain to turn into flour. Good personnel instead of...
Yeah. What would be examples of the most effective grain to give them? What do you mean by that?
Well, it depends on the country and what food that they're eating.
So for some countries, it might be more suitable to send durum instead of...
Oh, yeah, definitely. But some that are malting barley. There's feed barley, but there's also barley for food that can be mixed, like that you have a barley soup and products like that. So those in Ottawa would deal with a grain department, asking department, and then would meet with these people when the World Food Program would send personnel to Canada, see what their policy was. We were trying as anxious as possible to ship it in seasons where we could get the most benefit. You know, where the exports provided to them.
So that you could do it in slower seasons so that it wasn't competing with the...
Mm-hmm. But also to get particularly what the individual country wanted, needed.
Right.
They're not all the same.
Rather than just dumping whatever you had.
This is it, yeah, no. And what we found in certain cases, I'd always, listening to them, but we'd tell them, try to find out what they already eat, where did they get it normally, and why is there another country that has that, where they could get it from that country, and we'd supply the wheat to this other country to pay for that. So cases have been made to that extent.
Is there a section of the Wheat Board that dealt with that, or it fell under your...
Well, it fell under me for my years in Montreal, and the chaps in Ottawa would call with them. There was a green division there that was in trade and commerce. And developed in
Is there still a group in
trade? I didn't know you, the government was saying, well, the millers weren't really interested in shipping flour. Once it was loaded, they didn't get worried about that. Certainly there was flour, but only for those that can use flour. But the authorities would, as long as they got it on a ship.
Which might not have been the most useful.
No, the World Food Program was the best sense, and going for projects that were built around the world. And yeah. Then they hired some of our people. Mr. Vogel, one of our chief commissioners, became the director general. There were two. Then there was a deputy minister from the Manitoba government here that went to Rome. Very, very good organization.
So we talked a little bit about what brought you the most satisfaction. When you look back at your career, what do you think was the most challenging thing that you ever had to deal with?
Oh, very difficult. On short notice to think about it, I don't. I sure know a lot of people. And just how much.
Nothing pops to mind?
No.
Oh, shoot. Book that outlines the.
Yeah. Okay. So an awful lot of nice people.
We stopped the recording. Mr. Rowan brought out an address book that his secretary had kept during his time with the Wheat Board, which outlined the various countries that he had had contact with and the people that were involved in those contacts. And in going through it, he mentioned that he had visited Russia over 40 times. So a lot of travel. Just a couple of questions to finish off, and these are more.
Yes, I don't know if I showed you. So when I retired, to get this type of message from Moscow.
So when he retired, do you mind if I read it into the?
Yeah.
Okay. We learned with great sadness that you finally retire from Canadian Wheat Board, thanks to mutual satisfaction of both organizations. Your contribution was invaluable at times when we had to overcome occasional problems. We hope that in the years to come, our relations with CWB will continue to be based on mutual understanding and cooperation. Please note that you will always be welcomed in Moscow as good old reliable friend. Before your retirement, all your friends in Exportleb join us in sincerely wishing you, Anita, and the kids very good health, happiness, well-being, and all the very best in life. Yours truly, Oleg, Mikhail, Yuri, Eugene, three Borises, Alex, Vladimir, Andre, Dmitry, and many others. Best regards.
You get that officially from?
I'm just looking for the year that this would have been sent. 1988, is it?
Yeah, 88.
Or 1988. So with the signatures, great.
All Canadian Commissioner Service and the people that.
Good. So you haven't decided yet where your records are going to be housed.
No.
You'll have to let us know. So the last couple of questions have to do more with our project than with you. So if you'll bear with me while I sort through my papers here.
Isn't this something?
That date book is amazing.
Yes, yeah, so it doesn't, I
such
had
a small
this, and
book
the secretary had one.
This relates. This question actually relates to your date book. Are you aware of any memorabilia, including pictures, that you feel should be preserved to commemorate the history of the grain trade? Other than your records, which I understand are substantial. Should we do an inventory of those just to know what there is at some point? Would that be something that we could help you with?
Yeah,
if there's something you'd like help with, let us know.
Yeah.
And what part of, this is a big one, so it might be difficult to answer. What part of the Canadian Wheat Board's history is important to preserve and share with the public? Because remember we were talking to you that at some point we hope to certainly have a website to share your stories and other things, but at some point even maybe a public center for the grain trade. So what part of the Wheat Board's history you think is important to let the public know about?
Have copies of their annual reports, which were really covered all the details. I tell you, it's not a, I know what private companies, but I know that there was a record independently, yet they had independent accountants, or something, and every transaction, every day, they received a copy. Not a matter of them coming at the end of the year and doing a revival. So the records that they came in were just, and so in the various annual reports that but the overall I was just handling that transportation, and that the big dealings were with the producers of the 200,000 and all the deliveries at Country Elevators, and so the personnel, because as I say, most of the exports, we had these accredited exporters that did business, and we were a go-between, but the big part of the board was attending to, some of them passed away, and documentation.
Which brings up something that we had talked about earlier off tape, and that was computerization of the records at the CWB. And there was a special project, was it with IBM?
Yes, one of the first computers that were put in. They asked us, so which was smart, so that other companies could come and examine their work, or have personnel come over to our offices.
So IBM approached the Wheat Board?
The board, and they put in that. One of the surprises I got each day, we did often, I would travel with Air Canada, and the confirmation came in, and I read the paper, and I'd say, well, this is a strange address. It was our address that the most of the, at that one time, the reservations and that were made were through Air Canada's office. They had the one whole floor in the building where we were at, one next door.
Using the same computer system?
Yeah, so it, as new ones came in, they would put it in. And so other companies and here in Winnipeg, major companies or others, could come in and see and have their people spend the time before they made a decision of buying one. So some of the first computers that were in there.
Because of the masses of paper that they had to deal with.
Well, over 200,000 farmers, but 5,300 elevators. You can imagine every truckload and wagon load that they kept. Staggering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now that's part of the story to be told. I think a lot of Canadians have no idea of the size of the
operation. And then
operation.
The number of rail cars loaded. This not only the
amazing.
So the bulk of that work was them. That business, and then the recognized exporters that did most of the trade, because a year the board sold it, and which we did, but I mean a big benefit to those countries too.
Mm-hmm.
Good traders and yeah.
So we've come.
I was very fortunate in my years.
They were very fortunate to have you too, I would say. Well, certainly. Dedicated, knowledgeable, friendly, outgoing, good at languages, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked very well for both of you.
I met her yesterday, it took Anita, she went to the dentist, and I was sitting in the lobby, and a lady was asking me something, some information about it, and then she said, and I said, where are you from? And she said, I'm Portuguese. I said, muito obrigado. And she just looked at that.
So that helped.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of things.
The difference between Spanish and that and Italian,
yes, exactly.
I got into them.
And speaking of thank yous, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to share your stories with us. It's going to be a valuable addition to knowledge
well,
about
and then,
the international brain trade.
I continued even after I retired with people at and doing trade at Thunder Bay, as I was involved with the Russian trade of other goods. And about arranging, we got the range to bring cargoes and in ships that unloaded cargoes. Of goods and that then could be picked up and shipped out in Western Canada. So I showed you some of the letters there with the people.
Yeah.
Oh no, I always had a good spot about the people there.
Yeah. I guess what comes to my mind about that and something I've learned, one of the many things I've learned from you, is just how important it is to have cargoes coming and going. And from what you said today, even with the building of the elevators and the St. Lawrence closer to the Atlantic, a lot of that had to do with, not that it was a great place for grain, but it was a place to pick up the...
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and the great, the Japanese, almost everything, the ships, that the cars and everything else, and they picked up grain and threw away. Yeah.
Well, thank you again. I'm going to shut this off and with our thanks.
Yeah, I was